This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Frank Bryan, an LSU basketball great, one of the pioneers of the early NBA, an all-star before Bob Pettit or Pete Maravich or Shaquille O'Neal, and now a member of the LSU Athletic Hall of Fame. Frank Bryan celebrating his 90th birthday with us today. Also on the show, Garrett Temple, another former LSU great, who's the player representative for the Washington Wizards. And the Wizards have advanced to the second round of the NBA playoffs, and we'll talk with Garrett Temple about that and the controversy that has engulfed the Los Angeles Clippers owner, Donald Sterling. And Bill Medley, the man who was the big voice, along with Bobby Hatfield, with the Righteous Brothers, on his long and enduring career. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkstershow@WRKF.org. In a bit, we'll hear from Bill Medley, the great singer with the Righteous Brothers, who is still doing it after all these years and has written about his life and times with his book, The Time of My Life. But we start with Frank Sands Bryan, the pride of Zachary, Louisiana, one of the great basketball players of any time who began his professional career in the 1940s. He was there when the NBA began, and Frank Bryan, along with Pete Maravich and Bob Pettit and Shaquille O'Neal, the only NBA All-Stars produced by Louisiana State University. The other three are listed among the top 50 players in the history of the game, and some say that Frank Bryan is right there with Maravich, Pettit, and O'Neal. He was inducted in the LSU Athletic Hall of Fame last year at the age of 90, and he is celebrating his birthday with us today. Good morning to you, and happy birthday, Frank Bryan.
Thank you, Jim.
Move a little closer if you can, and you've had a long and distinguished career on the court. And I know you still follow the game. And Frank Bryan, you were there when the NBA began. Was there any way to envision what it became, and what it is now?
Well, I had played in NBL for 3 or 4 years before that time. And in 50, they put them together. And the players at Fort Anderson, I was selected to go to Chicago. And I didn't like the boys. Well, I liked them, but I didn't feel like that's where I wanted to go. So they traded me to Moline. That was the Hawks at that time.
Now these towns, Moline and Anderson, Anderson's where you started, the Anderson Packers in 1947.
And Moline consisted of Davenport, and they're made up to Tri-Cities.
Where is Anderson located?
In Indiana.
Okay.
Right out of Indianapolis.
So you played there and later played at Fort Wayne, which the Fort Wayne Pistons became the...
I went from the Hawks over to Fort Wayne Pistons.
All right. And before they were the Detroit Pistons, they were the Fort Wayne Pistons. But you had a great career at LSU before you went to the NBL. What do you remember about your times at Louisiana State University?
Oh, I always was a LSU fan. I had several of my sisters had gone to LSU. One of them taught there for a while. So I just about had to go to LSU. They were always one of my favorite schools. And being from Baton Rouge, you can kind of see why.
Well, sure. But your LSU career was interrupted by something called World War II.
Right, it was.
What happened with you and the big war?
Well, I went in and I was really lucky because every time that one of my units would leave to go overseas, they'd keep me back for some reason or another. One year for the BMR and the EKGs, they needed somebody to run them, and I had ran them before. I was familiar with them, so they got me to do that. A couple of more years, it'd be somebody that had seen me play, and they said, hey, you played at LSU. Would you like to play with our Army team? And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to. But at the same time, I wanted to go with the boys I had trained with. Right now, I'm glad that I didn't go because there's a lot of them didn't come back.
We're hearing the voice of Frank Bryan celebrating his birthday, actually number 91 with us today, born May 1st, 1923. Served in World War II, had a great career at LSU, and was one of the leaders of the NBA in the genesis when the league began in 1949-50. The NBL was the precursor. Frank was there as well. He was nicknamed Flash because he was the NBA's fastest player at the time. Played the first seven seasons in the league's history and in the first two All-Star games in 1951 and 52, and was All-NBA twice. So you had a fine career in the league, and it was somewhat different then than it is now, I would think.
There's a lot of difference now. For some reason, back when I played, if you put your hands on them, they'd call you for a foul. Now you can just about push them any way you want them to be pushed. And the same way with steps. That old thing of just having one extra step, it went out the window a long time ago. Now you can have two or three steps, especially if you're going to dunk the ball or you're going to how can you take the ball between your legs and around your back without walking? You can't hardly do that.
Well,
but anyway, it's good for the game.
Mm-hmm. You were inducted in the LSU Hall of Fame last year, and you became the first inductee without a degree. Your degree was interrupted by World War II, so I think it's appropriate that you're in the Hall of Fame. Should Pete Maravich be in there as well?
Oh, I feel by all means he should be in. That's been one of the things that I've pushed all along, that here they named the building after him, but he's not in the Hall of Fame.
And the Hall of Fame is in the building.
He needs to be. He's one of the greatest players we've ever had. Well,
right.
He needs to be in the Hall of Fame.
And he was inducted, Frank Bryan was, in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame in Natchitoches in 1986. And it's appropriate that somebody toots the horn of a guy like Frank Bryan. And without the gentleman who's in the studio with him, Buddy Wicker, I don't know if these honors would have been accorded to him, worthy honors. And Buddy, I think it's important that Frank's place in history be acknowledged. And you've done a great job in making sure that's happened.
He was very deserving. You're right, Jim.
Why did you embrace this cause?
Well, the reason I embraced it is because about 3 years ago, LSU formed a committee, mm-hmm. and they selected the team of the century, the top players in 100 years of LSU basketball. And they were going to do 10, and anyway, they increased it to 16. And Frank was not included in that 16, and that really, that's what made me, decide to try to, promote him.
Well, and he, Frank Bryan, ranked in the top six in NBA in scoring for three straight seasons, 50, 51, and 52, the first three seasons of the league. He was a sharpshooter, 85% from the free throw line. That's almost as good as Chris Jackson. Did you do set shots in those days?
Well, my free throws, I usually shot them with two hands,
yeah.
Because I felt like if I'm going to practice free throws, I'll use the same procedure shooting long shots.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of all the controversy this week about Donald Sterling, the owner of the Clippers? Have you followed that at all?
Well, yes, I've seen what I've seen in the papers, and I think, of course, it wouldn't amount to a whole lot, but I feel like that he got punished for something that I didn't think that he really needed to be punished that bad for. I mean, you should, and all of us are guilty of saying things in our home that we don't, it's not published.
Well,
I feel like they made a big mole out of
A mountain out of a molehill.
Well,
he has a history of making these kinds of statements, and it finally came back to bite him. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from Garrett Temple, who's the player representative for the Washington Wizards. But the league is such now that owner of a franchise like Mr. Sterling, a franchise that's been a perennial loser, it's still worth over $500 million, and he'll probably get more than that when he sells the team. Are you amazed at how pro basketball and sports in general, professional sports, how it's evolved since you were a part of it?
I can go back even farther than that. In high school, I didn't even know that they paid you to play basketball. I'd never heard of some of the teams that they had. And in 50, they came to LSU and asked me about coming up and playing with Anderson and what they would give me. Well, at that time, the salaries are not anything like they are now, but they were more than you could make going out just working with that, you know. And I was just tickled to death to get it. And I went up to see him before because I had a chance to go to work for Philco. And I had to decide whether I wanted to play basketball or go to work for Philco.
Well, so who would have thought it'd be a close call? Today, that seems unimaginable, that it'd be a close call between Philco and the National Basketball Association.
Yeah.
But you made a choice that worked well for you and left a mark on the league, and we're glad you have spent your life in your homeland. Frank, by the way, was not only a basketball standout, he was also a track stalwart at LSU, running the 440 and the 220. The low hurdles, the broad jump, and one of his teammates was the great football player, Hall of Famer, Pro Football Hall of Famer, Steve Van Buren. So he just died last year, didn't he?
Yeah, it's been the last few years.
So both of you had amazing lives, and I think you've got a few more good years in the tank, at least a few. Thank you, Frank Bryan. Good to visit with you, sir.
Well, I appreciate you asking me down.
And happy birthday. And we're joined now by a gentleman who will be celebrating his 28th birthday in 1 week, who played at LSU as a guard, as did Frank Bryan, a familiar name to LSU. His father was on the show a few days ago and was the first African-American to play at Louisiana State University on the basketball court. We're joined now by Garrett Temple of the Washington Wizards. Good morning, Garrett.
Good morning, Mr. Hanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You can call me Jim. Garrett Temple, who played in the John Brady, Glenn Davis years, is now with the Washington Wizards as the player representative. And right now, you're in the middle of the playoffs. Your team has advanced to the second round. First time Washington's done this since 1979. So I'm sure the nation's capital, in fact, I was there last week. They're juiced up about the Washington Wizards right now.
Yeah, the city is definitely buzzing. They're happy for us. Every time you go get some gas or go get food, you know, a lot of people come up to you and tell you how proud they are of you. And, you know, it's great for the city, but we really feel like we're just getting started.
And Garrett was an undrafted player, and he had to work his way up the hard way, and he has gotten to the Wizards by way of the Houston Rockets, Sacramento Kings, San Antonio Spurs, Milwaukee Bucks. You played in seven, and the Charlotte Bobcats, 75 games this year for a team that has a chance to win it all. I'm sure that there's something to be said about tenacity and resilience. It didn't come easy for you, did it?
Nah, not at all. Not at all. It definitely didn't come easy. I was very persistent in my goal. I had a goal in mind. I had a dream in mind, and I was very persistent in trying to reach it. And when I signed my first guaranteed contract this year, I was very proud that I was able to, work that hard to get to this point. And definitely not satisfied, hoping to have a few more careers in it.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with Garrett Temple. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Michelle Southern is producing, and we're rejoined by Garrett Temple. He's an NBA player and the player representative with the Washington Wizards, now in the second round of the NBA playoffs for this year at 6'6". Temple played at LSU from 2005 to 2009 and became the all-time leader in minutes played for the Tigers, 4,432 minutes as a Fighting Tiger, and now he is a Washington Wizard. Now, as the player representative, Garrett, I know you followed the travails of Donald Sterling this week, and there was talk of a boycott. Was that serious?
It was serious for a few of the games. I think the Clipper-Warriors game, I think they were pretty serious if the punishment for Commissioner Silver passed down wasn't hard enough. But we discussed it, but we didn't feel it was necessary to boycott our game. At least from the Wizards' point of view, I don't know what the Bulls talked about, but I think it was serious, definitely for the Clippers and Warriors game.
And your former teammate Glenn "Big Baby" Davis is a member of the Clippers. I'm sure this is a curious time for him.
Yeah, definitely. I spoke to him once, and he just spoke about how crazy it was that it was happening with his owner. You know, he hadn't had any run-ins with him, and I didn't know about the previous things that, you know, Donald Sterling had done until this came out, and then I started researching it. So, you know, you can get away with things, you know, long enough before eventually they come back to bite you.
Do you think this has been handled appropriately by the commissioner of the league?
Yes, I really do. When I was watching the press conference, I have to say that I was shocked when I heard it. But, you know, looking at it, it's really the only thing that could have happened. You know, a lifetime ban. You don't want anybody with those type of views to be a part of your organization. And, you know, it is America. We do have freedom of speech. But, you know, the NBA is its own entity, and we, you know, you can decide who you want in it. And we don't want to be involved with anybody with those type of views. So I think it was the right thing to ban him.
Well, coaches sometimes are tough on players, but when coaches or anybody else starts talking about race or referring to race in the estimation of another individual, then that's crossed the line. There's no doubt. But there are those who say, look, Sterling crossed the line, but my goodness, this was a private conversation, and he's being punished for something that of the 30 other owners or 29 other owners, some of them may have made remarks similar to or worse than Sterling. They just didn't have their girlfriends taping them. Is that a valid assessment of what is the reality of this episode?
Exactly. You know, in the reality, you know, they may have people that feel that way. But the reality is when it became public, And they found out that it was Donald Sterling's voice. You know, it was. We found out that he does feel that way, and we can't have anyone in our league with those views. Like I said, it's freedom of speech. You can talk however you want to. You can say whatever you want. But at the end of the day, the NBA is its own entity, and we can decide. You know, you can decide who you want in this league. And if somebody does feel that way, and they make it known that they feel that way, that strongly about those things. You know, it's not, I don't think there's any place for it in our league. And I'm glad that Commissioner Silver feels the same way.
Now, Garrett, you, as I stated, were undrafted, and yet you hung in there. You played in the D League for Rio Grande. You played abroad in Europe. Stayed the course, and now at the age of 27, almost 28, you played 75 games for one of the best teams in the league this year. I'm sure chasing this dream has been something that has been quite heartening to you, because you've achieved in many ways what you sought to do.
Definitely. You know, when you go through as many teams as I've been on, go to Italy, play in two or three D-League teams, five or six NBA teams, when you finally reach that goal, it's that much sweeter. And I'm definitely not satisfied. I definitely think I have some years left to play, but it definitely feels good when you're not given anything and you really work hard for what you got.
We're visiting with Garrett Temple, the Washington Wizards guard and player representative, probably chosen because of his smarts, and the son of Collis Temple, who was with us a few days ago. 297-5633 in our remaining time with Garrett. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Rick Causey writes, if this issue arises with a player in the NBA, should the player be dealt with similarly as Donald Sterling was? Is there a distinction between a player and an owner?
I think there is a distinction, but, at the end of the day, after this penalty being, put there, the NBA family is one, and each person in this family, has to be accountable for their actions. So with that being said, if a player were to say the same things, I don't see how the reaction shouldn't be the same, honestly. Donald Sterling is an owner. He is the head of a team, but we've realized, fans go to see players play. The Clippers go to see Chris Paul and Blake Griffin play. They don't go see Donald Sterling. So with that being said, if a player said that, them being the face of the franchise, the face of the team, I think that the same punishment may be validated. Maybe not the same amount of money, because players may not be as worth as much, but the lifetime ban, if it happens, I would not be surprised at all.
Okay, 297-5633 is your number, and we'll take a call or two in our remaining time with Garrett Temple. Tom in Mid-City, hi, you're on the air with Garrett Temple.
Hi, Garrett. I was really impressed where Jim just kind of walked us through your career and how much work you've done to get where you are. I'm interested, what would you say were the most important improvements or changes in your abilities as a player that, say, today compared to when you first maybe tried out for the NBA and didn't make it? What is it that, how have you improved?
I think the biggest improvement was honestly understanding what my role should be in the NBA. One of the biggest things is coaches tell you when you first get to the NBA is, do what you do best and don't worry about anything else. You know, they bring you on a team for a reason. And so if you're not a three-point shooter, don't try to shoot threes when you finally get in the game. You know, if you're a post-up guy and you're not a guy that dribbles the ball a lot, don't try to become, a point guard. So I think the biggest thing was understand my role and do it to the best of my ability.
You're 6'6 and about 200, is that right?
Yeah, 6'6", 195, 190.
Okay. But your wingspan is much more than a man of 6'6", isn't it?
Yes, sir. It's about 6'11", 6'11 and a half.
So that explains why you're such a good defensive player. Those arms are coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, they definitely help out a lot.
6'11", my goodness. And you're a big man to begin with. You've seen players drafted high first round, who didn't last as long as you. Is it a matter of commitment, tenacity? What makes some guys stay the course and thrive at the age of 27 as you, and others flame out long before they are 27 or 28 years old?
Yeah, you hit on the head. They have guys that have been first round draft picks that are finished at age 24, 25, and I think the biggest thing is commitment. I think luck has a lot to do with it. You have to be in the right place at the right time. But once you get in the NBA, you have to have the right attitude. Not everybody's going to be a superstar. Not everybody's going to be a starter. Two-thirds of the people in the league are not starters. So you have to have the right attitude. You have to be a great locker room guy, be a great teammate, because people definitely look at that. They don't want to bring in somebody that won't be playing that much, that will ruin the team in terms of being that bad apple. So I think my team first mentality, my locker room attitude, and my work ethic has kept me in the NBA.
Who's the best player you've played with or against?
best player I've played with, I'd have to say Tim Duncan. You know, he's going to go down as, you know, arguably the best power forward to ever play the game. Best player I've played against, I'd have to say LeBron James, because he's just, I mean, it's impossible to stop him. If he wants to, you know, if he wants to do something, it's really impossible to stop him with one guy, maybe even two. So, and he's so unselfish. He just understands the game so well. I think LeBron's going to be the best I've played against by far.
Well, Garrett, we wish you and the Wizards well, and thank you for joining us in the middle of the playoffs. Good to hear your voice again, and congratulations on your success.
Appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Garrett Temple. And we're joined now by the legendary Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers. Almost 50 years after the release of You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. 34th, by the way, on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 best songs of all time. Bill Medley remains one of the most memorable voices in the history of music, with the Righteous Brothers and Bobby Hatfield. Good morning, Bill Medley.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. It's good to hear your voice. Let's go ahead, Michelle. Bill has written about his life and times in The Time of My Life. It's an insider's look at the music business, and a half century is a pretty long commitment to your craft. You're still doing it, though. You love what you do, right?
Well, I love what I do, and still doing it, and I have my daughter out there singing Time of My Life with me, and life is great. Why would you quit this?
You won a Grammy, a Golden Globe, an American Music Award, an Oscar, and Video of the Year honors. And Bill Medley was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2003. It's interesting how it all began with the Righteous Brothers. As these things go, it didn't happen by osmosis. What caused you and Bobby Hatfield to get together and change the course of music history?
Well, Bobby had. We were raised in Orange County, California, and he had a small little group called the Variations, and I had a group called the Paramours. And a mutual friend of ours came to town and took Bobby and Bobby's drummer and myself and my guitar player and put us all together, and we were the Paramours, and Bobby and I just started singing a lot of duets in the nightclub, and I had written a song called Little Latin Loopy Lou, and a friend of mine that owned a record company came in to see us, and he said, man, I love that song, Little Latin Loopy Lou. He asked us if we wanted to record it, and we said, sure, and we did. So, and it became a hit. In 62 and 63, and the truth is the public pretty much made the Righteous Brothers. Mm-hmm. Bobby and I really never sat down and had some big plan of making the Righteous Brothers or teaming up together, but thank God it happened.
Yeah, you have a chapter, and it's entitled The Green Light from Sinatra. Old Blue Eyes, he liked you, didn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Sands Hotel in Vegas wanted to book us in there, but they had to get Frank Sinatra's okay, because when we were going to be in the lounge, which seated about 500, it was a huge lounge, it was almost as big as Frank Sinatra's room, and Sinatra was in the main room with Count Basie and Quincy Jones conducting, and he had to okay us to be in the lounge while he was in the main room, because he would take a lot of his parties, you know, all the people that would fly in from Hollywood to see him, he would bring them into the lounge after his show. So he had to okay who was in the lounge, and why he okayed us, I don't have a clue, because this was back in, you know, 65.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Sinatra and the Righteous Brothers were probably at opposite ends of the musical spectrum. But he said, yeah, I'd love to have him. He'd call us the kids and told us all about how to keep our voices, you know, out there in the desert. You know, you get that, what they call Vegas throat. It's real dry out there. And he was wonderful to us.
I'm sure he loved your voice. You have.
Well,
go ahead.
I don't know. I think maybe he, you know, because we were so young, I think he, maybe we reminded him of himself in those days. And, he did like the voices. He thought they were real voices because he had heard enough rock and roll that he wasn't thrilled with rock and roll, but, he liked what we did.
Well, your voice, as we can hear it now, it's quite distinctive, but when you open the mic and start singing, that baritone, it sounds like it comes out of the bottom of a barrel and just keeps on going. I'm sure you had to cultivate this. It didn't just happen, did it?
Well, no. When I was 15 years old, I was a first tenor in choir. I was 5'3", and grew about 7 inches in 1 year, and my voice went from a first tenor to a, I guess you'd call it a bass baritone, and singing rock and roll with this kind of voice and having bad sinuses, it all worked.
Phil Spector, what about him? He had an impact on your career.
Yeah, everybody that asked me about Phil, I know they're expecting a horror story, but Phil Spector, he wanted to produce us back in 64, and he asked Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil to write a song for us, and they wrote You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', and we went in the studio with Phil, and he was great with us. He was, a real good guy to work with. He worked us real hard. We weren't, you know, we had been recording for about 3 years before Lovin' Feelin', and he pushed us. I mean, I think to get the vocal on, I think we did 8 hours, 4 hours one day, and then 4 hours the next day. But we didn't mind because it kept getting better and better and better.
The voice is that of Bill Medley, along with the other half of the Righteous Brothers, Bobby Hatfield. They recorded such hits as You've Lost That Love and Feeling, You're My Soul and Inspiration, Unchained Melody, Rock and Roll Heaven, and his worldwide number one hit, I've Had the Time of My Life with Jennifer Warren's, earned or Bill a Grammy.
Trying hard not to show it, but baby.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. The guest is the Righteous Brothers' Bill Medley. His book is The Time of My Life. He continues to perform 50 years after the Righteous Brothers became household names, Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley. And we'll talk with him about some of his new recordings. We might even hear a snippet or two. But the book is The Time of My Life, and the life, like most lives or all lives, it has not all been fun and roses. You've had your share of tragedy. For example, your first wife, Karen, her life ended tragically, and that affected you immensely.
Yeah, in 76, she was... it was like an attempted rape, and she was killed in the process. And we were divorced at the time, and she was a mother of my 10-year-old son. And it was when she was 32 years old, and it was just amazingly traumatic. And then I was a bachelor at the time, and Darren came to live with me, so I took took about 6 years off. I retired or pulled out of the business for about 6 years to put Darren's and my life together, which ended up to be a wonderful thing for me. I certainly didn't like how it came about, but you know, when you're having hit records and all that success, you know, you have it kind of becomes your world and your rules and all that. So, you know, when I became a single parent, it kind of pulled me right back into reality, which was wonderful for me. And I think I've stayed there. But yeah, that was a real tough time. The 70s were very tough for me. And I think about 74, a couple of years before Karen passed, I'd lost my voice, and they said I'd never sing again. And my high school choir teacher, I ran into him, and he was giving voice lessons at the time. And he said, I think I can get your voice back for you. And so we worked for about 2 years. Did two vocal lessons a day, 5 days a week, and slowly but surely it came back around. So, yeah, the 70s were tough.
297-5633. A bit more time with Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In 77, Elvis Presley died, and he, of course, was older than you, but you knew him well, and as you write in your book, a lot of people claim to have known Elvis well, but you really did know the guy. I'm sure you were affected by his death at the age of 42.
Yeah, when we wrote the book, I told the guy that wrote with me, Mike Marino, I said, I'm not going to tell any Elvis stories unless you can talk to, George Klein or some of Elvis's friends, because now everybody that writes a book claims that they were good friends of Elvis's. But, unfortunately, I was working in Vegas, the same hotel that Elvis was working, and we spent a lot of time together, and I spent about 3 weeks with Elvis at Graceland every night, because I was recording in Memphis, and then I'd go over there at night, and we'd go to the movies or have dinner and everything. And so it was great. It was really wonderful. But I also, you know, was right in the middle of watching his decline, you know, and it was very sad. He was a wonderful guy. He was surrounded by too many people. He was afraid to go out in public and this and that, and it was pretty sad. But he was a wonderful guy.
Cleve asked an interesting question: who do you like to listen to? Who are your favorite singers, Bill Medley?
Well, Ray Charles is my favorite singer. I'm in reality a blues singer who got very lucky with some beautiful ballads, you know, like Love and Feeling. But both Bobby and I were kind of rhythm and blues singers, but Ray Charles, all those guys from the 50s. Matter of fact, I just released a new CD called Your Heart to Mine that's dedicated to all the singers from that influenced me from the 50s. And but today it's still considered old music. But I love the Eagles and Elton John, and you know, I love Bruno Mars. I think there's some good guys out there. It's just like when we were around, there's some good stuff going on and there's some bad stuff going on, but the good is really good.
Well, let's give a listen to Bill Medley 2014. Man who's been doing it for more than 50 years, and you'll recognize the voice.
Into my eyes. Well, when I begin, when I begin to realize. Oh, I've cried so much. Yes, since you've been gone. Oh, I'm almost drowning. Oh, in my own.
That's the man, Bill Medley, who can still do it. The foreword in the book, by the way, is written by none other than Billy Joel, and I think he puts it in perspective. He says, I still remember the first time I heard Bill Medley's deep, soulful baritone booming through my little Zenith 500 transistor radio. It was the summer of 1964. I was 15 years old, checking out the girls with my friends on Jones Beach. You've lost that lovin' feeling was about to explode into the sonic boom heard around the world. You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. Hit me and every other guy who heard it right in the gut. His voice personified the sound of a man wounded by love. It was a righteous epiphany. That puts it in perspective, and that's tall praise from a great artist.
Yeah, he is a great artist, boy. He just has written some incredible songs, and he's a great performer. He's a great performer, and a good friend, and that was very sweet for him to do that.
Another listener, Hallie, asks about Bobby Hatfield. How did his death affect you? You write about it, but that's another loss in your life.
Yeah, it's a tremendous loss. We all knew Bobby wasn't in good health, but so it wasn't a real, you know, a surprise that you know, well, it was a surprise that he passed away, but everybody kind of knew that he was in such bad health. But once it, you know, it happened, man, it was just amazingly dramatic and sad. And you know, I didn't discover until a couple of years after Bobby passed away, going on stage without him, is that, you know, Bobby, I was one of the Righteous Brothers, and when Bobby passed away, you know, part of me went with him, and it was very sad. He was a good friend, and one of the great singers.
What do you think about contemporary music?
Well, that's a tough question, isn't it? I mean, everything has changed so much because of electronics and what they can do in the studio today. You can take a pretty good singer and take them into your bathroom and make an album today. And you can fix their voice. You can do this. You can do it. So I guess that's good news and bad news. I don't know that all of these artists can go out on stage and duplicate what they, you know, what their records sound like. But I think possibly because it is so man-made, we're losing a lot of the emotion and a lot of the soul out of music, and that bothers me quite a bit. But there are a lot of acts out there that are keeping it real. So I think it's in good shape. I think it's the only thing that bothers me is that it's so recording is so done electronically now.
Now, you alluded to it, and this will be our last inquiry for Bill Medley, and it's a good one. A listener wants to know how you came back from the vocal cord problem. A lot of people don't. Once they lose their voice, it never comes back. Yours obviously did.
Yeah, you know, my voice is probably as good now, if not better, because, you know, when you're a rock and roll singer and you're, you know, singing rhythm and blues, I was probably singing all wrong, and I was doing three shows a night in Las Vegas, so it's like running on a sprained ankle once you get sore. But I was just amazed that he got it back, but it's taking those vocal lessons and realizing, you know, the real theory of how your vocal cords, you know, how the singing process works, and starting to do it correct, and warming your voice up before the show, and singing, you know, pushing from your stomach and singing from your, you know, from your face, and your vocal cords really, you know, are just something that you push the wind through. So it mainly now is because I have the knowledge. I can, if I start to get a little worn down, I know exactly what to do. You shut up during the day. You don't talk. And but thank God. And I have the kind of voice that you would think would never come back.
David Downtown, please be brief. David, you're on with Bill Medley. We'll slide you in, and the floor is yours. Hi, David.
Bill, glad to hear you. Glad to know that you've got a new album. I will get that. I heard you in Baton Rouge at LSU before we had really any performance places at LSU at the Cow Palace.
Baton Rouge, man. One of the great places of the country. In those early days, a lot of the places that we worked really weren't, you know, ready for rock and roll acts. And I can remember, you know, almost like you hear somebody do the national anthem and you hear that bounce back. And so we got a lot of that on stage. But, you know, and we were pretty loud for our day. I think they play our music in elevators now, but but we were pretty loud in those days. But it was we had so much fun.
Well, thank you. It's a great book, The Time of My Life, from Bill Medley. Kenny Rogers says, I thought I knew him, and then I read his book and realized that I knew the singer but didn't really know the man. If you liked him before you read the book, you'll love him now. So it's The Time of My Life. Thank you, Bill Medley, and congratulations on your continuing success.
Well, thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. And we're joined in our remaining moments, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with this gentleman for a more extended period sometime soon. West Baton Rouge Parish President Riley Berthelot has joined us, and he is involved in trying to resolve some traffic issues on the west side. Good morning, President Berthelot.
Good morning, Jim. You're correct. We're trying to get a handle on this traffic.
I think you may be on a speakerphone, so if you can, get a little closer and tell us about the Louisiana 1 connector project.
Okay, the LA 1 I-10 connector is a short 3-mile connector that comes off the LA 1 and ties into the interchange on Interstate 10 at 415. It's about a 3-mile project, but you know, we have to tie in, cross a railroad track on LA-1, another railroad track on North Line Road, and then a bridge over in the coast and tie onto the interstate system. And it's a very complex project for a 3-mile project, and it's estimated at about $130 million for a 4-lane road to cross the intercoastal.
So what has to happen? What has to happen for this to become reality?
Well, we need some funding. Kind of went out and explored the option of this being a toll facility, and we did an investment grade study, and the tolls will not be enough to pay for the thing alone. It's going to need some help. It's going to need some gap funding through possibly the state, or some surplus money from the state, or, you know, some other form of I guess of funding on this project, and that's probably where we are right now, just lack of funding.
Well, how do you get the funding?
Well, we talked to our legislators, and you know, they all in support of the project because it is a needed project. Because when, like, the existing intercoastal bridge is that capacity, we have close to 50,000 vehicles a day on the intercoastal bridge, and is, you know, it's rated F, which is like the amount of service it can provide, and it's got probably the worst grade that you can put on the road. It's over capacity. It's 54 years old. These design for these bridges, when you design a bridge, they usually, it's designed for 50 years out, and we've achieved that. The bridge is going to have to be rehabbed probably in the next, say, 10 years or so. It's going to have to be rehabbed. And
well, we've got a roll, but we thank you for joining us, Riley Berthelot, Parish President for West Baton Rouge, and good luck with this project, and we look forward to an update. That'll do it for this week. Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.